So I was born. That's the first fact about me. Fairly self-explanatory, that, isn't it? I come from Lancashire. I was born in Blackburn in 1944. So right at the end of the war, very nearly at the end of the war. So it was a very gloomy kind of place. The austerity was quite, you know, everywhere was quite low-key and things were rationed and all that. And I grew up in quite a sort of dark sort of environment, really. Everything, my memory of my childhood seems to be very dark. Everything's very gloomy and not much colour. I don't think there was much colour around, actually, in those far-off days. Everything was brown and black and grey. And then I got myself a bit educated, slightly educated, and came to London in 1963, joined the BBC. I actually got a job with the BBC. That was my first expedition into the real world. So I became a sound engineer, working in London at Bush House. And strangely enough, that was a kind of odd place to be because I made lots of Buddhists seem to kind of congregate there. There's quite a few people in the order, used to be in the order anyway, who were also in the BBC in different departments. Probably some of them you won't have heard of now because they resigned quite a while back. But I met quite a few order members through that connection. So I'm quite pleased and quite thankful, grateful to the BBC. It gave me a kind of education. And I met quite a lot of people who I worked with. You know, they were quite intelligent, really. They're quite civilised people. So I kind of met Bhante in the process of going from work to home. That was my first meeting with him.
So where did you meet him exactly?
I met him in Mumman Street in our Buddhist information shop, it was called, Sakura in Mumman Street, which was in off St Martin's Lane in Drury Lane area, that part. Holborn. And I had I had a kind of habit of wandering through the streets rather than going directly home. And I kind of wandered through the streets in search of bookshops, really. And I happened to call in on this, or see this window full of Japanese objects and strange oriental things. And the man in charge of that shop was called Emile Boyne. He was French. And he talked a lot. And he liked people going into the shop because he could sort of talk to people and used to make tea for people. And one day, on a very cold winter's day, I went in to the shop and there was a strange man there who I'd not met before, aside from Emile. And he was a man with thick glasses and short hair. No, actually, he probably had long hair, actually. Yeah, before his short hair. And a long yellow-orange cloak, like a kind of Gandalf figure, which buttoned up right high up on his neck and came right down to below his feet. So you couldn't see him. He was like a sort of traffic cone. you couldn't really see very much of him. And it seemed to make his head very small, so all you could see was this big pointed cloak, you know, and a man hiding in it. So that was my first impression of Bhante.
So how old were you when you met him?
How old? Mm. Probably, I worked out it would be about 22. Mm. 21 possibly, 22, yeah. So pretty young and innocent, really. I had absolutely no idea what Buddhism was about. Literally no idea. Although I had read a book about it called Zen Buddhism by Christmas Humphreys. Mm. Christmas Humphreys was the person, the Buddhist person in those days. He'd written a lot of things about Buddhism. He was a prosecuting counsel. And he condemned people to death and things like that. But he was also a very prominent Buddhist. And Bhante knew him, of course. It was a bit of an odd sort of thing to be, really. Bhante was very up, you know, he knew everybody in the Buddhist world. And there was the Buddhist Society, of course, where Bhante did give some talks in the very early days. I don't know if you ever went to there. No. I went to one of his talks there, which was The Path of Regular Steps, I think. Mm. But that was quite a bit later on.
So can you remember how you felt, what your impression was when you met this man looking like a traffic cone?
Well, yeah, the thing is, what I haven't mentioned is I was in search of mystical truth in those days. I wanted some mysticism. I wanted to be magic. I wanted magic in my life, magic and mystery. So I was always searching for this element of mystery and the exotic. So that's why I went into this shop, really, to get books on magic and mysticism. One of them was actually called that, I think. So my impression of Bhante was that he was a magician who had some secrets that I wanted to get. And secret powers. One of the things that I always wanted, secret powers, I remember, that was very important. God knows what I would have done with them. Yeah, that was my impression, that because he looked so strange, you know, very different from your average city worker. He was a man who might possibly give me, if I played my cards right, possibly give me these secret powers.
So did you have a conversation with him that day?
I don't think so. Mm. No, I don't think. I don't think conversation was quite what we had. I was far too shy, really. But what I remember he did say, we're going to be doing some meditation classes. And would you like to join them? And I said, oh yes, I'd love to join them, because I might get secret powers that way. Never did get any. Yeah, so that was my introduction. Didn't really say very much. Mm. I was too shy, and I don't know why. He must have thought I was a bit weird as well. No. Wasn't much said on that occasion.
So the next occasion was?
Probably the next occasion was the Wesak celebration, which was the Buddha's enlightenment. I had no idea what that meant, but he said he was giving a talk at this place, so I went along, and it was free, another advantage. So I went along to hear him talk, and I was very impressed, you know. He gave me the impression that he knew things, important things, you know, which very few people did in my acquaintance. So I went along, and he did give the impression that he kind of revolved in different circles, you know, with very interesting people. So it was all about this air of mystique and mystery, and wanting to sort of get out of my boring, humdrum, routine life. So he was my entrance ticket to the magical mystery world.
So how did you start to get to know him?
Well, probably because he invited me. He was beginning to give classes at Sakura. We had a little basement shrine room, which Emil had set up, and he introduced. invited, you're only there by invitation, and he invited people to join this very, very small group, probably only about six, if you think, people who just used to do Zen meditation, you know, every whatever day it was, Thursday or Wednesday or Thursday evening. And then so we'd all go down to, this is before Thangarajah had started doing his classes, and we'd all go down there and just sit. And Emil would sort of sit up at the front on the dais and give us some teachings. Unfortunately, I was very disappointed because he didn't seem very sort of mystical. And I really wanted to find out what this much more interesting looking man in the orange robe had got to say, got to offer. But anyway, I went along to Emil's classes, and afterwards we used to go around. There was a little strange cafe next door to the shrine called As You Like It, and it was run by two gay people who were really nice, actually. they always used to talk very camp, you know, to everybody, and they had pictures of very illustrious Fabian sort of people, thespian people, theatre people. It was all the theatre world around there. So they had these pictures of these very, very theatrical types on the walls. So, and that was quite nice, because I felt we could relax a bit there and just get to know each other. And Bandi started coming in to these meetings after the class, you know, and the sort of inner circle, the inner sanctum, was invited to this class after the meditation, and we get the chance to talk to Bhante. So that's really how it started. And he was, yes, I can't quite remember what happened after that, but gradually more people started coming to the classes, so we built up a little sort of circle of people who were regular and came along. You know, they got the sort of inner teachings. so that went on for a while, and then Bhante started leading his own class. And then we started having the retreats. So the retreats came out of this little group that we had at Monmouth Street. And the first one, I think, was... I think we had the lecture series first on aspects of Buddhist psychology. That was the first thing in 67 in a hall in Kingsway. That was a bit weird because it was packed. I mean, they were public lectures. They were sort of advertised to the public. So you got all kinds of weirdos turning up. Quite a few hippies in those days. But also quite a lot of very, very business types, you know, business-looking types who would probably hang on after work, you know, after their business day, and wanted a bit of intellectual stimulation. So that was very much the feeling of that that group was.
Mm. Can you remember what impression those lectures made on you?
Yeah, I Well, it was interesting because it was all about psychology and Jung and Freud and Alexander David Neil and all these very strange names haunting the precincts of the civilized world. But they were just... I didn't really understand any of it. It was all... these little hints were being dropped and... You gradually picked up more clues to what was going on as you went to succeeding events. And then we had our retreat at, I think the first one was at Quatermain School in Haslemere in Surrey, in the country. And that was a week, and, you know, that was when it really started, because then we had much more time and people could ask questions that they daren't ask, you know, at their classes in London, and go for walks with a master, you know, get sort of special attention. And he would give an evening lecture there, like an evening talk. So yeah, and we'd have puja. That was really weird, the puja, you know, chanting and bowing and that kind of thing, you know. It really struck me as very, very weird, and I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to be associated with all this bowing and scraping and mumbling, mumbo-jumbo, and foreign languages.
Did Bhante say much about that at the time?
No, he didn't.
He introduced it?
No, he didn't. He just did it, really. Oh. And he'd do it sort of word by word. So he'd say, Namo, Namo, Tassa, Tassa. It was very slow. he didn't explain it, no. But gradually he did. As time went on, he'd explain it. This was Pali, and this was the Buddha's original language, and so it had a huge provenance, very important. Went back 2,500 years, and there was a huge lineage of people going back through the generation. So gradually, the picture was built up of something much more kind of exotic and, yeah, mysterious. Mm-hmm.
So was it on that retreat that you started to have more of a personal relationship with him? How did that come about?
Probably not, because things didn't move that quickly. I was very shy, and probably I went to walk with him. You know, that would be the most that would happen. And I'd sort of gradually sort of get a feel of who he was, and the fact that he had been born in London, and a bit more of a human personality emerged behind it. But you see, the thing is, in those days, everything was divided up into very rigid categories. So you couldn't have kind of someone who was interested in art and literature in the same pigeonhole as a Buddhist, It was all completely, didn't join up, So he was a Buddhist who was Westerner, not an Indian, not a Tibetan. He was a Buddhist teacher, and who wore strange clothes, who didn't do any work, and yet he had this mysterious kind of knowledge, and he was also interested in the arts and poetry, which I was getting interested in. So all these things just didn't make sense, because they weren't in the same universe, And I didn't see how one could connect with the other. And so it's always very, very gradually that I began to realise that there was a connection between these things, it was hard to really, it's hard to give the impression of how strange all this was, because like in those days, yoga was strange. Nobody did yoga except weirdos, and vegetarianism as well. Good God.
It's interesting you say it kind of progressed slowly, but yet that was 1966.
Or 7, perhaps.
Was it? And then you were ordained the following year.
In 68.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. But the thing is, there was no mistress system at all. I had no idea what ordination meant, even when I was ordained. There was no explanation. He just said, right, would you like to be ordained next week? and you come and you sort of, he'd explain what was involved, and it meant sort of coming along regularly to meditation classes and doing the odd retreat in between on your summer holidays, That would be it. Just there were no lectures. There were no lectures to listen to. All that started after April 68, when the order got going. And I think, well, as you know, there are 12 people ordained. But very few of that 12 knew what it was all about, I think Bhante's strategy was, we need an order, right? So ordain these people so we have an order, and then we can start doing things properly. So, most of us hadn't the slightest clue what Buddhism was about. And if I had, I would have run a mile, of course. So probably it was quite a good strategy. He'd have never got anybody ordained if he'd explained what was involved. Because the thing is, certainly for me, I was terrified of the idea like I might have to give up something. That was my big fear if I became a Buddhist. I might have to give things up that I liked, like money in that sort of thing, you know, and dress up in his weird clothes. You know. I wouldn't be able to buy records and books. I proved that wrong. You know, but really, that was quite seriously what I feared most in becoming part of the order, is that I wouldn't be able to have things. I'd have to give up all my possessions. Not that I had very many there anyway. You know. But I did kind of like meals, things like that, going out for meals. That was something I enjoyed doing in those days. Don't really do it anymore. But I thought, God, if I get ordained, I won't have any money, so I'll have to give up having going out for meals. I mean, that was the sort of thing the way my mind thought, you know.
And quite early on was when you started recording Bantu.
Yeah.
Could you say a bit about that?
Well, how did it happen? Well, because I was in the BBC, that was my job to record. I was a recording engineer, and it was all done on tape, of course. Those huge machines, which could have, not only did they cost an arm and a leg, they took an arm and a leg off you to carry them around, because they were so heavy. So I had one of these because, well, that's one of the things I like to do, is to record music off the radio. And I lived with my friend Tony, who was also a BBC engineer, so we had a little flat in Baker Street. Which cost 4 guineas a week. I'll show you how long ago it was. So we listened to music and we had meals and we collected books and poetry and talked about poetry, that sort of thing. And I stopped, because I had one of these expensive recording machines, Bantu got to know of this and he said, well, I think I probably asked him, would you like me to record one of your talks, you know, and then we can play it to our retreats and things like that. He said, that's a good idea, Stephen. And why don't you do that? And so I lugged this bloody thing to on the trains all the way to Hazelmere and recorded his talks. So that was the first 7-inch reels and all that kind of thing. It's a real palaver, really. So anyway, we built up a collection of his talks gradually, and that was the beginning. And then, because I had a recorder, then I persuaded the movement, you know, which was Bantu, Emil, Mike Rogers, who became Sudhata. That was the finance committee. So, right, we need another tape recorder. Otherwise, we can't duplicate these tapes, you see, so we bought another one. So then I began to copy the originals onto new reels. This is all on quarter-inch recording tape, you know, huge thing. And I used to post them out to groups. You know, when we started a group in New Zealand, I remember. It was one of the first groups we had, and Bryson had one, Hastings had one, Nottingham had one. So I think they were the first ones. And I would sort of spend my weekends duplicating these tapes. It was really slow because there was no high-speed copying. You just played the tape and you copied it as it played. You copied it onto another one at a time. You know. So it took 2 hours to do each one.
So that's the very seeds of Free British Audio.
Yeah.
And some of those talks that you recorded will be the ones, because there's some very early ones on Free British Audio from the 60s.
Yeah.
So that would probably have been you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
With your machine.
And I sort of got these, I remember carting these huge, I mean, they're really heavy as well, I don't know how he did it. Just shipped them out by post to New Zealand and Nottingham and Ireland and places like that, because they were, you know, they were just people who were interested in, they had a little group, they wanted a group, you know, so we sent, would you send us a Bantu's talk so we could set up a group, you know, and play these talks, so that's how it started.
Yeah. So meanwhile, back in the swinging 60s, you're getting to know Bantu better.
Yeah. What's the question?
The next stage of you getting to know him, because I know you said you went away with him.
Right, yes, that's right. Well, that began as we had the first retreat, then, and I can't quite remember how it began. He said, we have a little cottage, you know, so would you like to come for a weekend and, you know, spend time with Bhante? And I said, oh yes, you know, get some teaching, find out how to levitate. because really that's what was in my mind, you know, mystical powers, you know, reading minds and all that kind of things. So I thought if I spent some time with him, I would find out how to read people's minds, and, you know, all these things. So anyway, yeah. So we went away and I discovered he was interested in poetry. So I said, oh well, I've written a few poems. I started off writing, I think the first things that I was interested in was writing sonnets, because that was what poetry is supposed to be, so I wrote sonnets. And I wrote Shakespeare's sonnets, Shakespearean sonnets. And Bhante was really impressed that I'd written a sonnet. He said, this is really good, Arnold, you know? This is really good poetry. So I thought, oh well, if he thinks it's good, it must be worth something. So I used to start sending them out to magazines, you know. Never got anything accepted. But Bhante thought they were good, so that was what mattered. So yeah, that he was very encouraging, and he used to give me books on Keats's poetry and Shakespeare sonnets and Dylan Thomas, so Milton, Shelley, all those people, and I'd never even heard these people before. I had no idea who they were. So gradually, I began to see that poetry. Why was this man, who was a Buddhist scholar and knew everything about Buddhism that there could possibly be to know, why was he interested in poetry? It didn't make sense. You know, poetry is about love and that kind of thing, you know, and gazing at the moon. What else is it about? Death. it didn't make sense, but gradually we did talk about this, and I think probably he explained, well, poetry is a way of, another way of looking at these things, these feelings and emotions and aesthetics, beauty, all these things. This poetry was about that, and Buddhism was also about that. And that was a revelation. Buddhism about beauty? How come, you know? How could Buddhism, which was all about asceticism and giving up things that you liked, how could that be about beauty? So it's totally bizarre, all this. You know, I couldn't put all these things together. And it really took quite a long time to see what Buddhism, I mean, even after several years after I was ordained, I didn't really understand that Buddhism was about feelings, you know, because in my language, in that world, feelings were completely divorced from anything like that. You know, Buddhism was about magical powers and mysterious powers and intellectual knowledge, and Uspensky was like, you know, Uspensky and Gurdjieff, all these weird people who were sort of slightly oriental and had these strange systems of thought, and Schopenhauer and all that. So that was what, you know, that was all part and parcel of the teachings of Buddhism. So they were a million miles from poetry and beauty and feelings, you know.
So was Bhante talking about spiritual friendship at this stage?
I'm not sure whether he was or not. I think very tentatively he probably did, but I think that probably came, as it were, in his talks a bit later, when we had a bit more of an order. And see, by then we'd started going away on weekends together as an order, and I think by then we're probably about 1970, 71 or 72, we'd started going, the order as it was, started going to retreats together. And then we'd play a bunch of tapes, and then we'd have discussions about them, and we'd say, well, Pujas, what's all this mumbo-jumbo in Pujas for, you know? So, well, it's all about emotions, And poetry is about emotions, so we then started having poetry readings. I remember with Vangisa, who was one of the first order members, a real Irish character, who was really larger than life, and he organised poetry readings about 1970, I think, before he was ordained. He was Terence O'Regan, and he was a poet, who already was a poet, because he was Irish, so he had to be. And he hired a hall in this pub in Holborn, and we started doing experimental poetry. And one of the things I was very impressed by, he started doing readings of the London Telephone Directory. And this went on for about half an hour, you know, in this very loud, sort of broad Irish accent. And we're all drinking the Guinness, you know, knocking about the Guinness. And, it's very weird, very weird. But I suppose what was actually happening, Banty tolerated all this, but I don't think he really, you know, understood why we were doing all this. But anyway, he told us.
He did drink Guinness, didn't he?
He did, yes, he did. Yeah, he did a retreat. He started very deliberately drinking Guinness to try and, you know, because it was the age of flower power and hippies and living in camps and drumming and all that kind of thing. Still going on, that, isn't it? So, yeah, gradually I think Banty realised that we needed to get this stuff out of our system. Or even into our system. we need to recognise that we had emotions, and that was okay to have feelings. Buddhism wasn't about getting rid of feelings. I think that was a really big issue for such a lot of people. In order to meditate, you had to get rid of your feelings, you know, push your feelings away somewhere else, because they had no place in the spiritual life, you know. So that was a mountain to climb, you know, to get over that strange idea. And actually, feelings were important if you wanted to do anything with your whole heart, you know. And the spiritual life needed your whole involvement, so you had to have your feelings involved. And a lot of his early talks and retreats were about that very thing, you know. Bringing the feelings in and transforming the feeling and making us feel okay about having feelings, you know. Because a lot of us felt, I think, that if you had feelings, they were angry feelings, they were sort of really nasty things, you know, unpleasant things to have feelings. So you had to sort of pretend you didn't have them or actually get rid of them. So that was it was a big problem, you know. And I think it took a lot of retreats and a lot of lectures for that to begin to sink in.
So when did you realise he was starting to think of you as a friend?
I think that took a few years, because I mean, he obviously had this great idea that friendship and the spiritual life were part and parcel of each other. In fact, you couldn't have the spiritual life without close friendship. But that idea was really anathema, and I was shocked, you know, when he sort of started inviting people to his flat and became very intimate with them. You know, he'd invite people to dinner and they'd stay in for the night, you know, and that, my God, you know, this is terrible, this can't be anything to do with Buddhism, you know. But it was his way of starting to introduce feelings and friendship, positive emotion, you know. It was such an alien concept, positive emotion. And actually having feelings for men, you know, the same sex, this was completely out of court, you know. And I actually was shocked, I was deeply shocked to see that this was going on, you know. And I didn't want to know at all about it, you know. Because it was bad enough having friendships between men and women. Well, because that involved emotions, and that was unspiritual. That's what we're trying to get away from. But so to allow this in was quite a shocking thing, quite a revelation. But he did insist on it, really. He wasn't going to give up on this, and it was obviously something we had to come to terms with, you know. Not only were men and women allowed to be
friends, well, up to a point. But men and men and women and women. Women could go away by themselves without having this other sexual thing hanging over their heads, you know, and they could go on retreats without having men there. And men could do the same. And there's this, so gradually this idea of friendship became, you know, we gradually understood that there was this French thing called friendship, which was positive and which could be encouraged, and you could still be spiritual. You know, it wasn't separate from being a Buddhist. You know, and that was such a big issue. You know, really took a long time. I would say it took about 10 years for that idea to be really accepted. So the first decade, he had a mountain, he had an uphill job trying to sort of drum that idea into us. And it's hard to communicate how hard that was and how difficult that was, really. Mm. So in a way, now we take so much for granted, don't we?
So did you have a sexual relationship with him?
Well, I had. It was physical. We slept together, but it wasn't really sexual because I just resisted it so much. You know? I just was horrified. And I felt, this man can't be a spiritual teacher if he wants to sleep with his students. You know? So I thought, no, I don't want any of this. You know? But, you know, he just went on sort of hammering at the same old thing. So this is part of friendship, this is part of the energy you have to release to live the spiritual life. You know. It's all about energy and positive emotion. So, yeah, it gradually did sort of, we took it on board, I think.
But what effect did that have on your friendship with him?
Well, I didn't. I think I backed off a lot, you know. I did, and it almost produced a schizophrenic attitude in me because I wanted his spiritual teachings and all this mystical powers and magical powers. I wanted all that because I could see that he had them. It's obvious he had them, and nobody else that I knew did. But I didn't want any of that other sort of feeling stuff, you know, emotion stuff, because that wasn't spiritual. So I was in a real sort of schizophrenic sort of state, really, and it really did tear me apart, really. It was hard work.
What do you make of that now, looking back at that time?
Well, it was hard for him, because he'd come from India, with all this, you know, stuff behind him, where he'd obviously had, you know, friendships with young men over there, and it was much more acceptable. Well, I don't know if it was actually, it probably wasn't, but he came from a very different kind of society. You know, he'd been away from England for so long. For me, that was, it just took a lot of taking on board, really. Gradually, I did, but I began to understand that emotions were at the crux of the whole thing. And of course by then I'd moved into Ariyatara in about 69, which was the community, one of the first communities we set up in Croydon, Purley, South London. And we'd got a small order community, well not order, but there were some order members living there, just been ordained, about three or four of us. So we began to kind of, these ideas started becoming part of a normal discourse, you know, and we started having classes there, and we'd have discussion groups, and we'd have seminars and things like that, and we'd play the tapes, and gradually the ideas of friendship and emotion, positive emotion, bringing our feelings into our spiritual life. Bringing the spiritual life into our feelings as well. Gradually that became part of the sort of common sort of discourse, and it wasn't so shocking by then.
So in terms of your relationship with Bhante, it was like that was one phase of it, which it sounds like it took a lot of processing, but your friendship with Bhante has continued.
Well, yes, but there was a big hiatus for many years, really. Because I, then at that point, and probably this is not unconnected with what went before, at this point I kind of cut off from the order and moved out of Oratara, moved out of the community, and I went to art college. And I really just didn't have anything to do with the order for quite a few years. Mm. And this was in like the beginning of the 70s. Bhante had moved down to Cornwall to do a five-year retreat or something.
1 year.
1 year, yeah. So he retired out of the discourse, and I think he was finding it all a bit too much, I think, you know. He didn't really expect it to be so difficult. But, yeah, he retired from the fray and left a few order members like Gotami in charge, you know, the people he'd ordained a couple of years previously. He left, you get on with it, you run the show now, you know. I'm having this sabbatical. So he went to this little cottage, chalet on the cliffs in Cornwall, and we didn't see people. So, and I think he deliberately did that so that the order would get, the newly ordained people would get a sense of what it was to relate without him there, you know, without the sort of the father figure in charge of things, you know. And I think at that point he was quite ready to accept that the whole thing might just collapse. That it was on the cards, probably more than on the cards, that they wouldn't be able to hold it together. Because there were only about four or five order members who were very peculiar, very far from what we'd say integrated today.
Peculiar.
They were very peculiar. they were very, very... Actually, some of them weren't even... didn't accept Bhante's teacher in the community that I was in. We had about four different traditions. We had a Zen tradition with a Zen teacher. We had the Thai Vihara tradition, Hinayana tradition, with a Thai monk who came to teach. There was Jiu Kenneth Roshi, who was an American Zen woman teacher, who used to hold Zen sessions at Oratara. And there was another Tibetan teacher there, and there was other people. Zengo, yes, that's right. There's a chap called Zengo who became the Buddha Maitreya. He decided he was the Buddha Maitreya. And, you know, he was teaching classes, teaching Zen classes there while we were having Bhante classes there, you know. So we couldn't decide when we're in the shrine room. Some of them were facing the wall and some of us were facing the we were chanting in different languages. It was complete hodgepodge. Crazy. But at the same time, it was completely all over the place and disorganized and all that. But there was a lot of excitement about it because it was genuinely new and radical. You know, like we had all-night pujas and things like that, chanting all through the night, you know, smoking dope and all that kind of thing. The dope was a big scene then, as you probably realise. You know. Some of you probably realise. And it was like part of this transformation of energy, transformation of emotions. You know. It all went with that. You know.
So to pick up that thread again, so you've gone off and you're going to art college and you've put distance between you and the order. So you're not living in Oratara.
I'm living in a house, not even a Buddhist house. Mm. I'm living in a house owned by a friend who was a banker, you know, and wouldn't come even walk through the gates of Oratara, you know, if you paid him. Mm. But it was nice in a way because Oratara was just down the road, so I was in, you know, I did go to classes, there. But I had my own little pad, you know, and I was doing my diploma, design diploma 3-year course then, so it was pretty full time arts course. And I was very excited about being an artist, you know, and so learning all these new skills. So I was really into that, but I was also keeping the FWB at arm's length.
So what changed? What has anything changed?
Well, very gradually, I think, these strange ideas become normalised, you know. And people would... people used to go away together and have get-togethers and sessions and things like that and discuss all these things. And I think gradually these ideas of Bhante's...
Which ideas are you talking about?
Well, the idea of single-sex ideas, for instance, that men would go away together and become friends and women would do the same separately, you know. That was such a strange idea at the beginning, you know, but it gradually became acceptable, I think. People gradually understood that it made sense to have your emotions accessible, you know. And there was a big problem between the sexes then, because, of course, the new orthodoxy was that men could have sexual relationships, but men and women couldn't. So if you were a male order member, you couldn't have a girlfriend, or if you did, they were to be kept at arm's length, you know, miles away, and they couldn't be seen to be anywhere in the sort of the circumference of the magic circle of male friendship. You know, it was male friendship was the big thing. So in the 70s, suddenly, that's where it all happened, you know. And men used to sort of, this was like almost a kind of the new orthodoxy, you know, the new teaching. And if you didn't have that sort of intense, close, challenging male friendship, you know, you weren't really committed.
What did you make of that?
I wasn't. That's when I began to sort of distance myself, you know.
So you distanced yourself at that point,
yeah.
And you're sitting here now.
Yes.
And you've still got a relationship with Bhante. So
well,
can you...
there was a big distance, which went on quite a long time. And I think looking back now, what was happening is I was beginning to be more of an individual, be a bit more integrated. And accept that I had feelings. I mean, that was a really big thing. I had feelings, you know. And they were okay. It was okay to have them. And, you know, I do bang on about this because it was such a revelation, you know. In a way, it's a different age now. In a way, we almost accept this idea that feelings are okay. sometimes a bit controversial, but at least we have them. We know we have them. But yeah, it took time. And there was a period from about, I'm a bit hazy about the dates here, but about 1970, the early 70s, 74, 75, up to probably the end of the 80s, certainly 10 years, possibly 15 years, when I was really on the edge of everything. I basically wanted some kind of normal life, you know, a job. Because I'd become an art student and I had no money at all. And I went on all these retreats. Don't know how I managed to pay for them. And then I resigned from the BBC. So there I was with no job, no career prospects, no girlfriend, and no real self-respect, you know. I was in the wilderness.
So you didn't have any contact with Bhante at that time?
Very little, yeah. I mean, from 75, when this was the time of the LBC beginning to be built, with Subbutia in charge of all that, you know. And there was a big, sort of strong, all-male team, you know, where everybody sort of pulled together and sort of shoulder to shoulder and went away on holiday together and, you know, stood by one another. I thought a lot of rubbish, actually, I didn't, but that was the teaching, you know. And that, because we had a project, you know, an important project, which needed a lot of energy, it needed all this male friendship energy, which was being released, that had previously gone into romantic relationships with the opposite sex. I mean, I think that was the thinking, you know, we need to bring that energy back from projection onto the opposite, onto the whatever, the anima, because all that energy was then available for the building work, you know. We kept it sort of consciously, deliberately within the circle, as it were.
Mm.
While that was going on, I was an artist. I was becoming an artist and a writer and beginning to write poetry, and I wrote a novel. So I was beginning to do my own thing. I was beginning to do what I should have probably done many, many years before that. I just begin to be an integrated individual, you know, with a bit of emotional resources, you know, instead of being completely at sea and sort of projecting it all onto Bhante as the sort of father, wise father figure, which was, yeah.
You were saying when we were talking earlier that you did... You have been openly critical of Bhante, like writing to the Order newsletter, because you were saying you wrote with criticisms of Bhante and Shabda, and actually he was angry.
This was quite late on. I'm just trying to sort of see how that became about. Well, I think because I've been separate for so long, I've lived on my own, I'd have begun to have fairly long-term, stable, opposite-sex relationships. So I was a bit more normal human being by this time. I suppose that's horrible, really. but, you know, I was a bit more self-accepting. And I began to see that Bhante wasn't... Every word that he said wasn't absolute gospel, you know. That he could make mistakes. And, in fact, he had made a few mistakes. This is very hard. This was really hard for me to think consciously, to think about. Because I never, ever criticised him in my thought. It just was completely unthinkable to criticise, even question what he said, you know. Because we were the disciples, we were the students, and he was the teacher. So our job was to accept what he said and you know, be able to pass it on to the next generation of students. For that. And then... to realise that he'd made mistakes and he was actually doing things which all intents and purposes were against his own teaching, his own Dharma. This, you know, this was really strange, very hard to accept. And it took a lot of meditation on, so to speak, you know, But I suppose I realised that something had to be said. And of course now we're talking about the era when Yashapala's letter came out in... Yashamitra, letter came out in Shabda about what had happened, Bhante's having relationships with his students on retreats and things like that. And Women, Men and Angels, of course, was also... around a bit earlier than that, wasn't it? So, a lot of criticism about that, about Bhante's attitude and the basis of his attitude to women. So, some of us felt that it had to be brought out into the open, our perspective on it, and, you know, although he was a teacher, the job of the teacher wasn't just to tell us what the truth was and how things were, and what we had to do, how we had to live, but to so actually respect our perspective, our view of things. So it became less Bhante as the sort of autodidact, you know, the psychopomp is a word for it, was used, the unquestionable sort of authority figure, which he had been really up to, you know, a few decades, anyway. And really the whole thing about the Dharma was that we had to come to our own realisation of what the truth was. And part of that process was criticising his own behaviour. We couldn't continue in that way of accepting everything that he'd said when he was actually doing things which contradicted them. It became very obvious to a few of us that this had to... I remember we had a retreat, it was a preceptor's retreat actually, strangely enough, in which we were all sort of, all men of course, we all gathered in a room and talked this through, and we're very honest and open about what had gone on, and it's actually quite shocking what had gone on, you know. We were all hearing this stuff and we were reeling really with...
you know, the things that people were saying. And we thought, this is not acceptable, you know. How can a man be so high up in the Buddhist sort of echelons and so experienced and so authoritative, and yet he's actually doing things which don't fit with what he's saying, you know? So then I felt, after that, my response was, after thinking about it for a long time, I mean, you know, a couple of years, I felt this had to be put in writing, and I wrote to Shabda and put, you know, why is this happening, you know? And by then, of course, other order members, you know, were openly discussing the fact that it is possible for a teacher to make mistakes and to be fallible. And then that really, a lot shifted with that perception. Our teacher was fallible, was a human being, you know, not an infallible authority. And of course, really, that was part of his teaching, was that we're all fallible and we're all sort of human beings. We live in the human world. We're not automatons. It was part of the process which had begun a long time before, really, of realizing that you have feelings and that they're often at odds with what you think you should feel. And there are, you know, we're very disintegrated. We're not integrated. And Bhante is a very great Dharma teacher, and I still think he is, by the way. I've never really doubted that, but he was a teacher who was fallible in his life. You know, he didn't live up to everything that he taught. So I think that's how it sort of came through, in a way. By when we began to accept that, the whole thing changed. And the meaning of Bhante's Dharma, Sangharakshita's Dharma, became, we're all transforming ourselves as we go along, you know, transforming our emotions, our energies. And it's a process of gradually integrating all these different energies. You know? And out of that came his system of meditation, practice, didn't it? Which began with integration, which is a hugely important thing. So that system came out of all those years of experimentation and transformation. Yeah.
Although he first taught it in 1976.
Yeah.
I'm particularly interested to pick up the thread about your friendship with Bhante.
Right, yeah.
Because he, you know, there was conflict between you. He was angry and you did have communication about that.
Yeah.
So if you could also weave in your most recent final meeting with him.
Okay, I'll try.
That might be a good...
Yeah. Well, yes, he was angry, and I thought, all right, well, I've told my truth, let it stand or fall by, you know, if he disowns me as a disciple, that's fine. You know, I said, I still stand by that truth. It is the truth as far as I'm concerned. Although he disputed it, but, you know, that was his viewpoint, and this is my viewpoint. And I expected him to be very angry and reject me, but he didn't. He said he still valued my friendship. And he actually said in a letter, he wrote this in a letter, he said, I've often made allowances for you, things that you've done in your life. I would ask that you make allowances for me. So in a way, that was a kind of acceptance that he was fallible, that he wasn't perfect. And of course, obviously, he's not, how could he possibly be perfect, you know? But, you know, these things are so strong, aren't they, that we expect our teachers to be perfect and all the time, and never get anything wrong, you know. In a way, his fallibility was part of his teaching. And this is what I value now, is that, yeah, I'm still his friend, and I still, a few months ago, went to see him at Adhisthana. And I had it was only about a 20-minute meeting, but all the things I wanted to talk to him about just kind of went completely out of the window, and I just felt this great love for him. He was a human being who's really lived a human life and seen a lot of life and lost a lot, you know. He's lost his dear friends, in the most painful circumstances. He's had a lot of suffering in his own life, and yet he's come through all that, still integrated, still a human being, still very human. And in the end of that meeting, we just looked at each other and embraced, you know, and he didn't say anything. He just looked at each other. That seemed to sort of say far more than any kind of questioning him about what he thought, you know. It seemed far more important just to be two friends who cared for each other and respected each other. And in a way, that was part of his whole teaching that he'd been trying to get along, which had taken such a long time to come through. Basically, friendship was his teaching. And then there's no limit to that, you know. It could be endlessly sort of, nuanced and re-understood and re-transmitted, reinterpreted. There's no limit to it. I mean, in the end, his teaching to us is friendship, without limit.